Did you know that most of the dishes in Tom Colicchio's craft restaurant are made and made in pots and pans? The braised short ribs, made and made in. The Rohan duck, made and made in. The heritage pork chop, you got it. Made and made in, which isn't surprising. Made In has been supplying top chefs and restaurants with high-end cookware for years for the simple reason that Made In makes exactly what demanding chefs are looking for. Their carbon steel cookware, for example, combines the best of cast iron and stainless clad, gets super hot, and is rugged enough for grills or an open flame. Best of all, Made In is sold online, so the professional-grade cookware is far more affordable than other high-end brands. If you want to take your cooking to the next level, remember what so many great dishes on menus all around the world have in common. They're made and made in. Save up to 25% this Memorial Day from the 18th until the 27th. Visit madeincookware.com. That's M-A-D-E-I-N cookware.com. Please check it out.
Welcome to the Great Books Podcast. Today we'll talk about the Kennicott Bible. I'm your host, John J. Miller of National Review, and you're listening to a production of National Review. Our guest is Katrin Kogman-Oppel, a professor of Jewish studies at the University of Münster in Germany. She's the author or editor of many books and articles on Jewish book culture in the Middle Ages, including a brand new volume, The Kennicott Bible, a Masterpiece of Jewish Book Art, from Bodleian Library Publishing. She joins us from Israel by Zoom as we record from Hillsdale College's campus radio station WRFH in Michigan. Katrin, welcome to the Great Books Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Why is the Kennicott Bible a great book?
The great interest that this book raises, or raised ever since it's known, has first of all to do with the rich illumination. It's one of the most richly illuminated Hebrew manuscripts that survive. There are several miniatures that show biblical figures and other biblical elements, but there's also plenty of just ornamental decoration. There's dozens and dozens of pages that have some ornament on them. So it's very, very richly illuminated. Now, maybe just to start, what is actually the Kennicott Bible? Just to introduce it, it's a full Hebrew Bible according to the Hebrew canon, which was commissioned by a person named Isaac de Braga, or Yitzhak de Braga, in 1476 in Coruña in Galicia, northwestern Spain. It was copied by a fairly well-known scribe, Moses ibn Sabara, who signed all the other surviving manuscripts, which means that he was a fairly prominent and highly respected professional of the highest standards. So this is really a book, and it was also considered in the 15th century, a book of the highest standard. Interestingly enough, also the painter, one Joseph Ibn Chaim, signed his name, which is very unusual or very rare, let's say, because medieval painters or miniaturists usually did not sign their work, whether they were Christian or Jewish or Muslim. That was just not a norm.
We're going to talk about all that. What is the Kennicott Bible? What are its contents? The beautiful illustrations inside of it, the artists who made it, the Jewish world from which it emerged, and the story of how it's come down to us today. Katrin, when I think of illuminated manuscripts, I usually think of Irish monks decorating pages of the Gospels. Is the Kennicott Bible a Jewish version of this same tradition?
Yeah, certainly. However, there's not just Irish monks and Gospels, but there were also manuscripts of the Quran, and it is actually the Islamic artistic tradition that first impacted the emergence of the Jewish artistic tradition, especially of manuscript decoration, and that actually happened back in the 10th century already, at the latest. And it happened, of course, in the Middle East, primarily in Egypt. So it's there where we actually find the earliest illuminated Hebrew Bibles, and they share much with this Islamic tradition. They have carpet pages, they have plentiful ornamental decoration. Jewish manuscripts also display images of the temple vessels very often. We have those also in the Kennicott Bible. And a similar tradition actually develops then further in Hebrew Bible manuscripts from Iberia, which the Kennicott is part of. European tradition is a bit different. It starts only in the 13th century, and it certainly owes a great debt to the fact that the Jews of Europe lived in shared spaces with Christians, and that the Jews were to a significant extent familiar with this Christian tradition of book animation, even though this is not necessarily the gospel, but rather, say, manuscripts of the Old Testament or various others that probably interested Jewish viewers more. So we definitely can speak of a lot of familiarity. Jews were always familiar with the culture of their surroundings. So in some sense, yes, it's certainly the Jewish equivalent of Christian book illumination.
This book, the Kennicott Bible, produced in the year 1476, comes to us from, as you say, Iberia, specifically from northwest Spain in Galicia. What was that area like in the late 15th century when the Kennicott Bible was produced? What was the Jewish community there like?
Well, we don't know too much about the Jewish community of Coruña. It's basically part of Castile, and we know a lot about Jews in Castile ever since they lived there in the early Middle Ages. What we should not forget, of course, that this is less than 20 years before the expulsions of the Jews from Spain, from Spain and then later from Portugal and from Navarra. And basically, if we look at the larger picture of Jewish life in medieval Iberia, so the most important thing probably is that Iberia was a multicultural society. It was a multicultural society in every respect. Jews, Muslims, and Christians live in, as I said, shared spaces, and had a lot of exchange. There was certainly a lot of transcultural entanglement, and that's the atmosphere, that's the culture that these Jews lived in. But when we talk specifically about northern Castile or say northern Iberia in the late 15th century. So the story behind all this is that in 1469, Isabel of Castile married Ferdinand, the Crown Prince of Aragon. And after some subsequent political turmoil, the couple signed an agreement that would unite their kingdoms, and Spain was born. Modern Spain actually was born. There was no Spain in the Middle Ages. In 1492, they managed to conquer Granada, which was the very last part of Iberia that was still in Muslim hands. And 2 months later, the Alhambra Edict was issued, ordering all those Jews who had not converted to Christianity to leave Spain by July of the same year. So they had 3 or 4 months to get actually ready to leave the country and go into migration. And so the so-called Sephardi diaspora began, the migration of Sephardi Jews to other parts of Europe, to Italy, to the Balkans, to the Ottoman Empire, to Northern Africa. Many books were confiscated during those years. Many Hebrew books were confiscated, but some families managed to take their belongings and their books with them, and the Kennicott Bible ended apparently up in northern Africa, where it then later in the 18th century was purchased. So that's the story, basically. So it's a tense period. The expectation to convert to Christianity is in the air. Politics are difficult for the Jews, and again, 1476 is only a short period before all this happens. So that's basically what this is all about.
So this is the world that produced the Kennicott Bible, and we'll come back to the story of its rediscovery in a moment. But let's jump into the actual contents of this book. We call it the Kennicott Bible, but it's actually a Hebrew Bible. And when we say Hebrew Bible, is that just another way of saying the Old Testament?
No, the Hebrew Bible and the Old Testament are not the same. The Hebrew Bible consists of 24 books. These 24 books are the canonized version of the Hebrew Bible. Now, this canonization took place in the early centuries of the Common Era, when it was decided by scholars which one of these numerous books that had been written in the context of biblical literature, just, you know, in the centuries before Christ, what book actually is inspired by God, is divinely inspired, the writing was divinely inspired, and only such books could enter the canon. And they ended up, after a very long period, that this took place for centuries, actually, 24 books ended up to be part of the canonized Hebrew Bible. Now, before this canonization process actually began, there was a Hebrew Bible, of course. Jews read the Bible, and there were certainly also liturgical readings and so on. And this pre-canonized Bible was translated into Greek, the so-called Septuagint. And this version contained more than 24 books. Now, when the Christians eventually adopted the Bible, they basically adopted this earlier version. Hence, most Christian canons consist of numerous more books than those that entered into the Hebrew canon. The Christian canons vary from church to church. There's the Byzantine Orthodox Church, the Catholic canon, the Protestant canon. So they have slightly different Old Testaments, actually. Of course, the label Old Testament is also Christian because it is, from the Christian point of view, it is the predecessor of the Christian New Testament, which naturally is not part of the Hebrew Bible. So there is definitely a significant divergence between the Hebrew Bible and the Old Testament.
A lot of our interest in the Kennicott Bible is the artistry of it, but it also has script. It also has printed words. Are the words in Hebrew? Are they in Greek? What is the language of the Kennicott Bible?
Hebrew. Hebrew and a bit of Aramaic. Some of the Hebrew Bible is in Aramaic, like parts of the Book of Daniel, for example, but most of it, the absolute majority of it is in Hebrew. And the Kennicott Bible actually includes not only those 24 books, but also the so-called Masoretic commentary. I'll explain in a moment what that means. And also at the beginning and at the end, split actually into two portions, there are some grammatical treatises by a Sephardic scholar by the name of David Kimchi, who lived in southern France. He was an exegete of the later 12th and the early 13th century. He also had a great interest in grammar. Now, keyword grammar leads us to what the Masoretic commentary actually is. The Masoretic commentary is actually a commentary that came along together with the emergence of the vocalization system of the Hebrew Bible. The original Hebrew text, say prior to the 8th century, was an unvocalized text that consisted only of consonants. This vocalization system was created between the 5th and 8th, 9th century, probably, in the Middle East, in different systems, but one particular system made it to be the final system. And these scholars were, in general, very interested in philology and grammar and linguistics, and wrote commentaries that basically consist of very long lists, quite dry reads, I have to say, but long lists of words that appear just once in the Bible or twice in the Bible or three times in the Bible. And it is basically a kind of concept that attempts to organize the text. They exactly knew how many words are in every book and where is exactly the middle word in every book. And this is some sort of information they all put in this so-called Masoretic commentary. Masora means tradition, so that was a tradition that continued. And in fact, this commentary is, again, traditionally appears in more or less every Hebrew Bible, every manuscript Bible. It stopped with printing largely, but every manuscript Bible, it appears, and when you open the book on the Kennicott Bible and the plates, you will see that on every page there's three lines or four lines on the upper margin and several lines on the lower margin, and that is the Masoretic commentary. So this is also included in the Kennicott Bible. And then, as I said, there's this grammatical treatise, or several actually grammatical treatises by David Kimchi, which I go into a similar area of interest.
If you have a modern edition of the Bible, often it'll have an introduction, and there might also be annotations, appendices, and so on. Is this the 15th century version of that?
Well, you know, in a way you could say yes. It represents a very specific interest. And scholars often wondered if actually everybody who owned such a Bible read this commentary. And I don't have an answer on that. Several scholars probably did. But it's not an explanation that you could say, you know, they have a footnote and that would elaborate on the text or explain something that seems enigmatic or unclear. That is not aim of the Masorah. The Masorah is really very philological. So it was probably not in everybody's interest to read it, but it was a tradition to add it. It was simply there, and sometimes it was figural. It was decorated. Sometimes they would take the lines of the script and turn it into contours of dragons and animals. In the Kennicott Bible, this is not very dominant, but there's a bit of that also. But that was also a very common tradition in medieval Hebrew Bibles.
Let's turn to the art now of the Kennicott Bible. We've discussed it as an illuminated manuscript. But what is an illuminated manuscript? Is that just a fancy way of saying a colorful book, or is there a specific definition for illuminated manuscript?
Well, yeah, basically you could say that it's a colorful book that pretty much explains it. Illuminated comes from the Latin word illuminare, which means illuminating or enlightening. It has a lot to do that there was a lot of metal used in the colors. There was a lot of gold used in the colors, which was, especially when it was new, it was very shiny. It was full of light, basically. So I think the root is really this, especially bright colors and shiny colors. Basically, many scholars would just call any decorated manuscript, illuminated manuscript, even if it's just drawings without colors. That also exists. But so in a sense, yes, an illuminated manuscript is simply a painted manuscript, a decorated, or a manuscript that is decorated with paint.
I wish we could show images on this podcast. Of course, we can't. So, Katrin, I'm going to invite you to describe the art as best you can. It has abstract designs, animals, figures from the Bible. But how would you describe the art of the Kennicott Bible using only words?
Yeah, that is not an easy task, because even when I teach, I'm used to use PowerPoint, you know. But the one feature that the Kennicott Bible stands out so much is that it really has a lot of decoration. It's not every page, but it's dozens and dozens of pages that have some sort of decoration. It has a lot of very delicate ornamental pen work that for frames and for decorations on near the text columns and so on. It has carpet pages, which are part of the Islamicate tradition, artistic tradition, which means that they're fully ornamented panels that in a way look like carpets. I mean, they have designs like interlaces and similar designs that pretty much make it look like a carpet. And there's quite a bit of them in the some it's full pages, some as just panels. We have several figural illuminations there, which are actually unusual in the Iberian Jewish tradition, because Iberian Hebrew Bibles usually do not use figural decoration. They have very little. They have actually no narrative biblical scenes, for example. They usually go only with ornament or with some sort of an iconic decoration. From that perspective, the Kennicott Bible is unusual, because it has a bit of them. It doesn't have a lot of figural images, but it has a portrait of King David, for example. It has an image of Jonah being spit out of the fish's belly. So a few of those. It has a beautiful double opening of the temple vessels, a large seven-branched menorah, and the other implements on the opposite page, which is a very typical theme in Iberian Hebrew Bibles, and actually have two meanings, these pages. One is that they symbolize, actually, one should say, because these are very abstract. There's no building, there's no wall, there's no temple. There's just these very flat, that they appear like golden silhouettes, very flat implements spread on the page. They symbolize the messianic third temple of the future that will be rebuilt once the Messiah will come. And the second meaning actually is that when the Romans destroyed the real Jerusalem temple in 70 CE, after that period, the Bible as an object actually turns into a kind of a minor temple. It's called actually a minor temple. So it's a substitute. It became the temple for the Jews. Similarly, also the synagogue became the temple for the Jews. So this book actually is a temple. It's a temple, and these pages, that's what they tell the viewer, that this book is a temple. So that's basically, yeah. And then it also has, I mean, the Pentateuch is divided into weekly reading portions. And these, traditionally in Hebrew, medieval Hebrew Bibles, these reading portions are marked in the text on the margins. And the Kennicott Bible has a very intriguing, very interesting series of also figural and sometimes grotesques or hybrids or animals, all sorts of motives to mark the beginning of these weekly reading portions, which actually really, they appear in the first part of the Bible, the Pentateuch, they appear, I say, on every second, third page. They're, you will have some marker, and they're very, very intriguing, very attractive. They catch your eye.
This is a message from our friends at American Habits from the State Policy Network. We the people, do you ever think about what that means and what happened to it? We the people certainly did not mean an imperial city full of unelected bureaucrats deciding everything from kindergarten curricula to nursing home funding formulas. We the people means self-government, a free people deciding most things in their families and communities and delegating some authority to their towns and states while passing along just a small amount of that power to the national government. How did things get so upside down? At American Habits, we tell stories of real people with real solutions, all working to restore federalism and self-government. If you're a public official, come get involved. If you're a citizen, come and see the new standard for American leadership. No matter who you are, come help us renew the forgotten but not lost habit of American self-government. Visit AmericanHabits.org to learn more. That's AmericanHabits.org.
With so many illuminated manuscripts from the Middle Ages, we don't know much, if anything, about the particular people who produced them. In the case of the Kennicott Bible, we have a couple names. The name of the calligrapher or scribe, also the name of the illuminator. How unusual is that, and what do we know about these guys?
Scribes often signed their manuscripts. Usually there is what you call a colophon at the end of a manuscript. A scribe finishes the manuscript, and he then puts a kind of a contract. This is a sort of a contract or a confirmation or an statement that he finished the commissioned work. And usually in these colophons, you know, a small paragraph, he would say, such and such wrote these 24 books, they usually call the Bible, these 24 books, for Rabbi so-and-so on this and that date. And if we are really lucky as researchers, there he will also tell us where he did that. That is usually the information that you find in these colophons. So that is quite usual. And as I mentioned, Moses ibn Sabara was known also from other manuscripts. So he must have been a well-established and respected scribe, but we don't know anything more about him. He might later on have lived in Morocco. There are some signs that his name reappears in Morocco, and that's all we know about him. What is unusual is the signature of the painter. This is something that appears in one other manuscript that was created around 1300 in Tudela in Navarra. And we know that this earlier Bible from Navarra actually was in Corona since the later 14th century, because there are family records and birth records at the end of the manuscript. That is a very usual thing to do, that people use the empty pages at the end of such a manuscript to write down what dates their children were born, for example. So we know that since 1375, this book actually, at the latest, this book was in La Coruña, and it apparently served as a model for the Kennicott Bible. And so in both these Bibles, we had actually these painter's signatures, and they're very attractive. They're actually painted. They appear in very large letters. They cover the full page, and the letters are formed by plants and animals in the Kennicott Bible, also by figures. And so you can read them, but they're all very artistic letters, so to speak. So we have the names of both these people. The earlier one is called Joseph the French, Joseph Salvati. And the painter, the Kennicott painter, was called also Joseph Ibrahim. And that's all he says about him. He says, I, Joseph Ibrahim, painted and completed this book. He doesn't say anything more about it. So we don't know what else he did. There is no other book that we can recognize his style or anything. So he's there with one single book and left his name beautifully, and that's all we know about him.
Shortly after the creation of this book, it vanishes from history, as you say, partly because of the expulsion of the Jews from Spain. And then it reappears, and this is connected with how it got its name, the Kennicott Bible. But Katrin, tell us the story. How did this Bible come back to our attention? Why is it called the Kennicott Bible? Where is it today?
Okay, so let's start probably at the end. It's today. It's in Oxford in the Bodleian Library, and it bears the shelf number manuscript Kennicott 1. It was there since 1770. So we don't know exactly what happened between 1492 and 1770, but assumably it, as I mentioned earlier, after the expulsion, it ended up in Northern Africa. Because in 1770, Benjamin Kennicott acquired the manuscript, or arranged actually to acquire the Kennicott Bible for the Radcliffe Library. That was an earlier library in Oxford that eventually would become part of the Bodleian Library in the 19th century. This acquisition was done in Africa, so we know in Gibraltar. That's why we know that it must have been in Africa before that. Now, in 1767, Kennicott, who was a biblical scholar and a Hebraist, was appointed librarian of the Radcliffe Library. As I said, he was a biblical scholar, and after completing his studies, he developed a very sophisticated research plan to scrutinize a large number of copies of the Bible in various languages, Latin, Greek, Hebrew, and others. What I found very intriguing, that it was really a kind of a modern research proposal that he wrote. So what seems at first to be a perfectly well-conceived research project with a very clearly defined philological method was, however, that we know today, driven by anti-Jewish sentiments, because Kennicott, as a biblical scholar, was convinced that the Jews actually had corrupted their own scripture. He figured out this very meticulous comparison that he did, revealed divergences between the Masoretic text, that very text that was vocalized in the early Middle Ages. And so divergence between this Masoretic text and earlier Latin and Greek versions of the Bible led him to believe that the Masoretic text actually corrupted scripture, and that all sorts of interpretations entered or distorted the original Hebrew Bible as it appeared in the ancient period. So that was his idea. So the idea was dubious, very dubious. It was actually anti-Semitic, but it led him to acquire an enormous amount of manuscripts, among them also 10 Hebrew Bibles from the Middle Ages. And the Kennicott Bible, obviously, is one of those, and then became actually the number one of this little collection that he accumulated, together with the biblical manuscripts in other languages.
You worked with Bodleian Library Publishing to put out a new edition of the Kennicott Bible. The full title of your book is The Kennicott Bible, A Masterpiece of Jewish Book Art. Describe for our listeners, what is this book? What's inside of it? What do you hope a reader would get out of it?
Well, it's not an edition, because an edition would be that we would just copy the entire text, which it didn't do. But it is a very handsome book. It's a large scale. You have seen it. A large scale, beautifully illustrated book. They really did a wonderful job in their 150 color plates of most of the decorated pages. It contains an introduction. It contains three chapters, descriptive chapters. The book is not really a research book in the sense that only researchers will find an interest in, but it is actually aimed or addressed at a larger audience that would have, you know, various bibliophile interests, just book lovers. So one chapter is by Javier del Barco, who describes the contents, the precise contents, and there are different ways to, in the Middle Ages, there were different ways to arrange actually the contents of the Bible. So he describes that very, very carefully. There's another chapter by Maria Teresa Maite Ortega, which deals with the Masoretic commentary. And there is my own chapter on the illustrations. And there's also an introduction, which basically explains what I just briefly sketched about Kennicott and the way the collection was accumulated. So that is basically the contents of our book, richly illustrated. All the chapters are illustrated, and then at the end you have this full series of most of the decorated pages that are found in this huge book. And the Kennicott Bible is a big, has like 461 folios, so it's a very big manuscript.
It's a beautiful book, and I want to wrap up with one more question about your own experience as a reader and a scholar. You've devoted so much of your life as a scholar to this subject of Jewish book art. What's your story? What drew you to this area, made you fall in love with it, and want to share it with the rest of the world?
Well, you know, frankly, when I went to school first, I didn't even know that Hebrew illuminated manuscripts existed. So usually it goes, you know, there's a professor who does research on this and teaches and gets you enthusiastic and interested, and that's basically what happened. So I started I went to school in Vienna, actually, and there was a scholar, Kurt Schubert, who was, that was his field of scholarship. And then later I moved to Jerusalem. I continued my studies there. And there is a big department, actually. They have a center of Jewish art. So I became very interested. And then, you know, one thing happened after the other. And the rest is history, because all of a sudden you end up writing a dissertation on such a theme. And so, yes, that's basically what happened. And that's, I guess, what happens in many careers, that you just have an enthusiastic scholar as a teacher, and he does the job, or she does the job. And, you know, I study Jewish studies, but I'm also a trained art historian. So I work in art history methods, and that was my field, art history. But when you are an art historian, you go to a museum and you look at the picture, but you cannot touch it. But an illuminated manuscript, when you are a researcher, you go to the library and you actually handle it. And this touch of the material object, that really makes a big difference. And you sit there and you realize that you have in your hands an object that is 700 years old or 500 years old or 600 years old, and somebody else touched it and handled it and wrote it and painted it and used it and read it and so on. So this is some sort of an immediate touch with the past that I find really fascinating. It always gives me the thrill still. And you look at the Kennicott Bible or other pieces, and that is really this kind of feeling of immediate touch with the past.
Katrin Kogman-Appel, thanks so much for joining us and telling us all about the Kennicott Bible.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
You've just listened to The Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review. Please subscribe to The Great Books Podcast and leave reviews of the show. That helps us keep this podcast going. Send me your ideas for future episodes. You can reach me through my website at haymiller.com. On Twitter, my handle is @haymiller. Last of all, special thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode of The Great Books Podcast.
What kind of fun is waiting for you at Kings Island? The holy cow, we're way too high and here comes the drop kind of fun. The make a splash all summer kind of fun. The I can't believe I ate that whole funnel cake. Let's get another kind of fun. But most importantly, at Kings Island, you'll find for the fun of it kind of fun.
Don't wait to start your fun this season. Kings Island is now open weekends.